My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rossner. Liz, welcome to KABU, and welcome to Portland.
Thank you for having me.
Title of your book is Blue Nude, and it's published by Ballantine Books, and it's nothing like what the title suggests.
You think?
where did they put this in the bookstore? Did they put it with erotica?
You know what's funny? A friend of mine just told me that she went looking for the book in a bookstore in Los Angeles, and they had it in the mystery section, which is mystifying to me.
It really is, yes. That's a mystery in itself.
It is.
Well, you know, so this is one of those, I guess it would have to be under literature because it's clearly what you're striving for here.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. This is a book basically about two people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guy named Danzig. Danzig is German. He was born right after the war was over. His father was involved in the war.
Yes.
And it's a book about Mirav. Mirav is an Israeli woman. She's much younger, but, she's a Jewish from Israel who had to flee Israel because something terrible happened there and she just couldn't bear to be there anymore.
Right.
But before we even get into that, the very first thing in your book is, it's in the past, it's during World War II, and a German soldier comes upon a Jewish woman, that he assumes she's Jewish because she's hiding, in a barn, and she's so beautiful that he can't bear to kill her.
Right.
And he walks away. And you just, you know, I keep wondering, is it Esther? Is it not Esther?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Danzig's father? Mm-hmm. Is it not Danzig's father?
Mm-hmm.
Is that from whence everything floweth?
You know, it's funny. The truth is that prologue was written after the book was finished, or finished in my view anyway. And my editor said that I needed a new beginning, or I needed to rearrange something to make a new beginning. And it occurred to me that what I really wanted to do was to establish a scene at the start of the book that would sort of haunt the book. And although you say that it's a German soldier and a Jewish woman, in truth, the prologue has nameless characters and an unidentified setting and time. And one of my purposes there was to suggest that this could have happened anywhere, and there are enemies who have to face one another in a setting like that, even in this moment, even in our lifetimes. And that there's something about this question, can beauty save your life, that gets established in that opening scenario. Can you look your enemy in the eye, see the humanity in your enemy, and still kill them? So it's kind of a standalone moment in the book that I hope readers will reflect back on over and over again as they read the rest of the story.
Well, King Kong, it was beauty that killed the beast. But that's another story. Danzig and Mirav, am I saying Mirav?
Yes, you are.
Would seem to be polar opposites in many ways,
mm-hmm.
but they're not, are they? They're really much closer.
Yes, and I have to say that in my own experience as a daughter of Holocaust survivors, a number of years ago, I went through a series of encounters with a group of Germans who were descended from Nazis. And it was called the Acts of Reconciliation Project. And what we did was come together and tell each other stories and share feelings with one another in a way that allowed us to see that we actually weren't opposites. And that although in theory we come from the other side for one another, the more we listened to each other speak about what it was like to inherit that war, you know, we were all born after the war. Our parents were located on opposite sides, and some were victims and some were perpetrators. But we, this next generation, had all inherited these experiences, these stories, these feelings, as if they were ours, but they weren't truly ours. So what we had in common was a kind of burden of a legacy that we didn't quite know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
And so my desire to explore that in this encounter between Danzig and Mirav is very much in pursuit of that question. What do you do with what you're given as a set of stories about the past, as a set of beliefs about the world? If you've been taught to mistrust people with particular accents, do you have to accept that as a given in your life? Can you ask a question about that as an assumption and say, what does that accent really mean to me in this life, in my current reality?
Well, this is off the topic slightly, but if I can ask you a personal question, you can refuse to answer this, of course.
Okay.
But I've known a couple of children of Holocaust survivors,
mm-hmm.
and Both of them told me that their parents never really had a good night's sleep for their whole lives. Mm. Did you find that with your parents?
You know, I've spoken with a lot of children of survivors myself, and there's a real range of experience in those families. I do know and remember my father having nightmares, and I think my parents both displayed through my life a certain level of anxiety in waking and in sleeping life,
mm-hmm.
And transmitted a lot of that anxiety to their kids. And I would say that I don't feel myself to have been one of those extreme cases. I have met children of survivors who really walk around in a state of terror. And in my first novel, In the Speed of Light, I wrote about somebody like that, a son of an Auschwitz survivor, who really walked around on eggshells all of his life because of what his father went through.
Wow, this is, how many books have you written so far?
This is my second novel.
So, and they both had a Holocaust theme?
I call them Holocaust shadows. I mean, they're really not Holocaust novels.
Yeah, right.
They're post-Holocaust novels in the sense that they're addressing the question of what is the aftermath of the Holocaust still in our lives now.
Are you working something out?
Of course.
I always say that writing is the cheapest form of psychotherapy there is. Is it true?
Well, you know, it's not altogether satisfying as psychotherapy because there's a way in which you realize that the things that concern you continue to concern you. It's not that you fully resolve your material this way. I have to admit that when I finished writing The Speed of Light, I really thought I was done with that material. I spent about 10 years working on that book and drew very deeply on my emotional autobiography. I wouldn't say the facts of that novel are the facts of my life, but emotionally it's pretty resonant for me. And when I started writing Blue Nude and came up with this German character and this Israeli character, I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? Not again, not still.
Well, clearly the topic wasn't through with you yet.
That's right. And I think on some level I have to just trust that this is the material I've been given and this is what I'm working with because it's important to me. And I think it's important collectively. I have to say that I have some fear sometimes of being pigeonholed and categorized as a Holocaust writer, even a Jewish writer, even a woman writer, and therefore being assigned to a particular audience as if that's the only audience that's going to be interested in this material. But in truth, for me, these are universal themes about inherited grief, inherited trauma, moving past a wounded place, making peace with the enemy, reconciling with your inner demons, making art out of suffering. To me, these are universal human concerns and not concerns located in a particular time and place for a particular group of people.
Well, let's talk about Blue Nude for a while. That would be a good thing, huh?
Yeah.
Danzig. Danzig was born in 1946, mm-hmm. which means probably he was conceived at the end of the war, or at least when the war was just over.
Right.
He has an older sister named Margot. Am I saying that correct? Is it
Margot?
It's Margot, yeah.
Well,
we used to have someone here named Margot, so that was
really?
my second guess.
That's the German pronunciation.
Right. He's a nice kid. He's a sensitive kid. His father's mm-hmm. hard, mm-hmm. a hard man. But a lot of us who grew up with war veterans as fathers had fathers who were hard.
Mm-hmm.
His mother is kind of sweet. But his older sister is like everything to him. She's an angel. She's mm-hmm. intercedes with him. She comforts him at night. She's not his whole world, but she certainly understands him better than his own parents do.
Mm-hmm. She's more of his ally in the family than either of his parents, yeah.
And he displays some talent as an artist, a job description for which his father has nothing but contempt.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about Danzig's growing up.
Excuse me. Mm. I think that one of the things I remember finding out when I was learning about Germany during the war was this notion of degenerate art and the way in which an entire landscape of culture could be eradicated along with an entire population as if you can really cleanse people inside and out. And so I think of Danzig's father as someone who so outwardly and inwardly embodied the ideals of Nazi Germany, that the farthest thing from his mind was that a son of his would actually want to be an artist to express himself. That to him was a vile occupation.
Hitler's banal landscapes notwithstanding?
Well, that was the irony to me, to think about Hitler himself as a failed artist, as an artist, a wannabe artist rejected from art school, I think, 3 times. And, you know, in modern psychological terms, we would make such an obvious association between his feeling rejected by them and his lashing out at art in response, and his defensiveness turning into offensiveness. So for me, that also is sort of an undercurrent in the book, that Hitler himself was somebody who wanted to be an artist and was prevented from doing so.
Degenerate art was art that did not serve the state.
Correct.
Or modern art. Any and all modern art was degenerate art. All art by Jews was degenerate art.
Correct.
And it also applied to music. Jazz music, Broadway music, Jew music was all considered degenerate music.
And black music.
Yeah,
right.
And black music of any kind, right, yes. So that's Danzig. Now, but Danzig escapes Germany, gets over to the United States, and becomes an art teacher.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, there's an old saying that says, them that can do and them that can't teaches. Is that what you were thinking here?
Well, you know, I think in his case, as with many artists today, including myself for a long time, I taught writing for a long time, it's just downright hard to make a living as an artist of any kind, and teaching is one way that we can support ourselves along the way. He also has a period of time in which he's really succeeding as a painter. He's being very well received for a time and really seems to be heading toward the mountaintop of success, and is thinking maybe he can give up on teaching, and things go awry, and he ends up having to teach. And then that's a whole other relationship to teaching, when you're there not by choice but by necessity.
If I'm treading too heavily on the plot here, let me know. But he has been preparing canvases for painting. Mm-hmm. This whole thing you have to go through to prepare a canvas for painting. You just don't paint on unprepared canvas unless you want to, you know.
Right.
That's
Some
your
people
intention.
Do that deliberately.
Some people do that deliberately.
Right.
So what did he gessos them up or whatever it is that he does, and then they sit there and they sit there and they sit there. This to me is a metaphor for impotence if ever I heard one.
Well, for me it's a metaphor for a lot of things, and in my own experience as a writer, it's also a metaphor for being a blocked writer facing the blank page over and over again, trying and failing to begin a new piece of writing. And I have to say that when I was working on this novel, all the way through it, really, especially at the beginning, but even in the middle and toward the end, there were many, many times when I panicked about whether or not I'd ever be able to really produce another book and whether I'd ever be able to finish another book.
Tough. And it's really tough,
yeah,
isn't it?
And I can really identify with a composer facing a blank page of sheet music, a painter facing a blank canvas, a choreographer looking at an empty stage and space and wondering how to move through it. I think all artists bump up against that stopping place, and it's fear and despair and anxiety. I mean, there are so many different reasons for it, but I felt like I really understood Danzig's fear, and in his case, too, it was actually a post-success fear, and I had some vague equivalent of that by having a well-received first novel that then left me wondering, now what?
Yeah, never wish for something. You might actually get it.
You know, everybody kept on saying, beware of success, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I just could not imagine that that would be a problem.
There's one thing, I don't know if you intended this, but it really tickled me. He has, Danzig has a mentor back in Germany named Herr Professor Hoffmann.
Yes.
And he's his father, more or less, in a surrogate father to Danzig. He has a skeleton. Mm-hmm. In his atelier, in his studio, and this is so that students can see actually how the body works, you know, so that they don't do things that would foreshorten limbs and things like that.
Right.
And he calls them Herr Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And Danzig has a skeleton in his classroom, mm-hmm. and he calls it Dr. Memento, which I thought was very clever because of the obvious pun. Mm-hmm. But then it occurred to me that there's a thing. It's Herr Doctor, Dr. Memento, Memento Mori. Mm-hmm. And it, was that intended, or did I find something that wasn't there?
No, that was intended. You're a good reader. You're a careful reader. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thanks. anybody that challenges me like that, I always like it. I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rossner. She's the author of Blue Nude, published by Ballantine Books. Let's talk about Mergav. She's a kibbutznik, a kibbutz kid.
Right.
And she had a friend named Yossi.
Mm-hmm.
Yossi, they grew up together. They went everywhere together. They were like joined at the hip.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, once puberty sets in, they had some exploratory sessions together, mm-hmm. and I guess became lovers.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you reach a certain age in Israel, you go into the army.
Right.
That's the way it is. So after all their time together, Yossi, they split up because they're not in the same unit, and Yossi finds somebody else, and mm-hmm. in a very quick order. And this is very devastating to Mirav.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I lived on a kibbutz just for a few months, quite a long time ago, and one of the things that fascinated me about life there is that, at least on some kibbutzim that are organized in this way, the children really grow up together, not with their families, but as a group of kids. They visit their parents, who live separately from them. And what's interesting to me about that is the sexuality that shows up in those adolescent years of these kids is in some ways very different from what their adult sexuality will be, because there's a way in which it's very free, it's very open, they're able to be with one another in a way that's somewhat unsupervised, but largely just relaxed and natural. And yet when it comes time for them to really develop romantic relationships, they often look outside of their peer group on the kibbutz.
Oh, it's like incest almost, isn't it?
It is. It's as if they're family members to one another. And so that was my explanation for the way that relationship evolved for them, that it really was part of their growing up, but not truly going to be the path they would end up taking as adults.
Now, this is very common in anthropology, is that you mm-hmm. always go outside the group for,
exactly.
To marry.
Right.
Yeah. Mirav is an artist as well,
mm-hmm.
and she at some point also becomes blocked,
mm-hmm.
and she decides that she needs to make a few bucks, so she starts posing. And like anybody else, even in a place like a kibbutz where things are a little freer, I guess, mm-hmm. than we would like to think of, she has some initial reluctance to take her clothes off, but it turns out she's a very, very talented model.
Mm-hmm.
But her heart's been broken,
mm-hmm.
and so it occurred to me that by taking off your clothes in front of a group of strangers, you're giving yourself to everyone, thereby giving yourself to no one, available to all and available to none.
Hmm.
Again, am I finding anything here that wasn't there?
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. I think that you're right when you say that this is a discovery she makes about herself as an extension of her creative life. So in my mind, for her, it's more an opportunity to discover what it's like to not just be the maker of art, but be the muse for others to make their art as well. And in my own experience, I painted some and I modeled some, and I was always fascinated by that dynamic between the painter and the model. Who was the source of what? And talking to models, talking to painters, I've learned that the best models are almost always artists who really understand and appreciate that it's not just about freezing, you know, standing still, not moving. It's much, much more nuanced than that. And that there's a way they have to be so conscious about their negative space, the asymmetry of what they're doing, a quality of stillness that doesn't look dead but looks very much alive, and a way of being able to see themselves through the eyes of the people looking at them. And so for me, Mirav was discovering those abilities that she had that came out of her artistic sensibility and talent as well. And if I can mention as an aside, I wrote an essay about my experience doing that that's going to be in the New York Times Magazine in a couple of weeks on Sunday, May 28th. And I just saw the proof of it this morning, and it's called Full Exposure. And the subtitle is What It's Like to Be the Only Naked Woman in the Room.
Yes. Yes. For those of us who are not artists, mm-hmm. there's always a certain amount of prurience that, mm-hmm. that you know, and it doesn't. It's you have students who are going for a grade or trying to make a painting or trying to make a drawing, and you have a model that's working for a living, mm-hmm. and it's really much more ordinary,
yeah.
banal even situation than it seems to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people imagine that it's a very charged, erotic situation.
And you read about Picasso, and
right.
you know who never painted anybody and go to bed with.
Yeah, well, and I read a lot about painters like Picasso. Actually, Modigliani was another one who almost always seduced his models or felt himself to be seduced by them.
Yes, of course.
And to me, one of the interesting things is this paradox that many of them admitted that the erotic charge between them was best used for art when it wasn't satisfied sexually, and that the more they could restrain themselves and keep turning that tension into the artistic process, the more successful they were in coming up with a really great piece of art as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Modigliani, it's quoted in the novel, Modigliani said something like, you know, we did no more work that day, referring to something that turned obviously into a sexual adventure, and then the model was really of no use to him. And some of that may be more about men, you know, wanting what they can't have, and then once they have it, I mean, that's a generalization. But I think in the artistic sense, using that excitement and that tension and that mystery for the creative process is where the real juice is.
Yeah, once Beatrice and Benedict fall in love, they become Ozzie and Harriet.
Exactly.
It's kind of boring, though, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think you're right that some people really have a whole mythology about, oh, an artist model is really like a stripper or some variation of a prostitute. She's really being paid to undress, and it's all very sexy. But for me, it's really more about the body as art. And a series of shapes and curves and lines in space and this positive-negative dimension and how you use that to find some inspiration within yourself. It's really not an erotic thing, necessarily.
I'm guessing that our listeners now are thinking, well, she's an artist model, he's an art teacher, these mm-hmm. two got together on that basis at some point.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in the book. She shows up because another model has had to take a day off, and in walks Mirav.
Right. And that's really, the novel begins with this initial encounter in the classroom, and all of the things we've been saying about these characters and their histories are, of course, unknown to both of them. Mirav only hears Danzig has a German accent. Danzig tells himself that he's inexplicably drawn to this beautiful woman, isn't exactly sure why, but we find out later he recognizes her accent immediately as well, even though they speak very little to one another. And the book begins with that kind of implicit tension between them, drawn toward one another, repelled by one another in some sense, and this question of will these histories that they carry be revealed to one another, and will those histories prevent them from making contact?
You're in an eternal dance with your enemies just as well as with your friends, aren't you?
I believe that's true about the human condition, yes.
Yeah. There's, with Mirav being a model and posing in front of people, there's one line in this book that I said, whoa. The army, and again, Mirav was in the army. The army was the place where Mirav learned how to see and not be seen. And now all she does is see other people and be seen by other people. Again, I was looking for little clues about mm-hmm. how this book was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
I assume, again, that was something you wanted us to know.
Yes, and I think it's one of the paradoxes of the gaze, the artistic gaze, I mean, but also just the casual gaze. I really wanted to explore this image, this setting of someone being looked at and looked at and looked at as a profession, as a daily operation in her life, and yet always sitting with the question of, am I being seen? I'm being looked at. Am I being seen? Am I hiding in plain view? For me, that's a very complicated analysis of a psyche, you know, how much do I put myself out in the world to be seen, but what do I withhold, what do I protect and hide? And I think most people I know go through some dance with that question, the question of looking at being seen.
Is there anything to the coincidence that Margaret and Mirab begin with M?
That's very deliberate, yes.
It's almost like bookends on his life, isn't it, on Danzig's life?
Yeah, and again, we're treading on delicate territory in the novel, not to give too much away.
That's all I'll say.
But I think that it's especially significant that Danzig, when he first meets Mirab, isn't quite able to remember her name, and in his mind keeps referring to her as M.
Yes, yeah, and there's a scene in the book which if a careful reader will recognize that letter M as being significant.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so tough to dance around these things.
Well, it's okay. I mean, there's a certain degree of suspense in the novel that I want to maintain, and maybe that's why it was in the mystery section of the bookstore. But at the same time, in both of my novels, I think there's a way in which these are really novels about characters slowly being revealed, and it's not so much that there are moments in the story that come as shocking surprises so much as hidden pieces of character that become unveiled eventually.
I also wondered about Danzig's name, because Danzig is a city that has been both German and Polish,
mm-hmm.
and has gone back and forth endlessly, like Alsace and Lorraine and between France and,
right.
and Germany.
Right.
It's Gdansk, it's Danzig,
right.
it's, you know, and it's
right.
like, so again, more meaning in there?
Yeah, I think it's actually, to be honest, I had a ballet teacher when I was a little girl whose name was Danzig, her last name obviously, and for some reason I've always loved the sound of it long before I ever understood its geopolitical significance as a place. And I had been writing about this character, Danzig, for a long time before I even really got that he was German, and then when I learned about this was, you know, a very, very strategic port city that Hitler was trying desperately to control, and it does have a particular place in history that's significant, yes.
Wow, this has been fun. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Rossner. She's the author of Blue Nude, published by Ballantine Books. Elizabeth, it's been wonderful talking to you. Come back again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
To KABU Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, Ariel Gore interviews Dexter Flowers about her spoken mic, which is emerging as the hot, queer, and queer-friendly spoken word venue in town, and her new zine release party for the show Under the Sea. And at 10:30, on stage and studio, the topics are Damali Ayo's new show, Yarn, and Artist Repertory Theater's production of Theater District. Up next, it's Black Talk with a focus on books by Black authors.